projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. Now, this month, we're bringing you something a little bit different. In this episode of the Spoken Web Podcast, student contributor Kate Moffitt is revisiting a live panel from the 2019 Spoken Web Symposium called Feminist Noise, Silence, and Refusal. That panel happened right here at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it featured presentations from Lucia Lorenzi, Milena Dremeva, Brady Marks, and Blake Nemec, and it was moderated by me. You hear me introduce the panel and also laugh a little bit too loudly, a little bit too close to the microphone a couple of times. The panel was exploring how we understand sound and silence, voice and voicelessness, where they intersect with gender, feminism, and the expected, mandated, or performative aspects of speech. This episode also includes a new interview with Dr. Milena Dremeva that reflects on her presentation, as well as the larger project that it touched on, and the project of sonification in general. And what I'd particularly like you to listen for in this episode is the way that it expands on the way we've been talking about archival sound in the Spoken Web podcast so far. The reflections on noise and silence that you hear in these presentations, as well as in Kate Moffitt's discussion, challenges us to ask how certain sounds end up in the archive and what gets left out or ends up being unarchivable. A project like this one, the Spoken Web Project, is in some ways limited by what's there, by what's been recorded, by what we can find, by what we've already found. But of course, there's a lot of power and politics that goes into what ends up in the archive in the first place. We tend to archive things that are remarkable, that we mark as important. But that leaves out all kinds of banal background noise, what Brady Marks refers to as the acoustic weather. And when it comes to the challenge of archiving, how would we begin to think about archiving silence? It's particularly interesting hearing all of these different speakers reflect on these ideas in the form of an episode where Kate has essentially created an archive of an event that might have otherwise passed by unremarked. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how this episode grapples with the challenges of thinking about the relationship between feminism and noise. So without any further ado, here's episode 5, Revisiting Feminist Noise, Silence, and Refusal, taking us back to the 2019 Spoken Web Symposium as Kate invites us to listen toward a new decade of feminist sound politics.
In May of 2019, two inaugural Spoken Web events took place in Burnaby and Vancouver, British Columbia. The Spoken Web Sound Institute 2019 and the Spoken Web Symposium 2019, Resonant Practices in Communities of Sound. This episode of the Spoken Web podcast will be revisiting a particular panel from that symposium and talking to one of its presenters, Dr. Milena Dremeva. But first, let me introduce you to these two exciting events. The Spoken Web Sound Institute 2019 was a Spoken Web members event that took place at the Simon Fraser University Burnaby campus over May 28th and 29th. The Institute questioned how we work with sound, and with literary recordings in particular, recognizing the impact that Spoken Web, as a large-scale and widespread project, can have on the future of literary sound studies. How do we interact with sound in the archive? How do we curate it? How do we manage mass amounts of files in ways that make them accessible? How do we name them? How do we store them? How do we make them archivable and resilient in the face of technological advancements? How do we share what we're learning, the scholarship that we're creating, with a broader audience, with individuals both inside and outside of universities? The Institute not only endeavored to begin answering these questions by sharing current research projects and scholarship, putting on workshops on podcasting, copyright, oral history, and data management. But it also brought together the geographically widespread members of the project to celebrate the first year of Spoken Web. The Institute was followed by the Spoken Web Symposium 2019, Resonant Practices in Communities of Sound, which took place over May 30th and 31st at Simon Fraser University's Vancouver campus. Many of the themes and topics taken up by the Institute were represented, questioned, illuminated, and challenged by the symposium, which was open to all scholars and creators, and brought together students, teachers, authors, artists, and scholars to share their work in the field of sound studies. The wide-ranging presentations, which included everything from recreations of old radio broadcasts to analyses of the use of accents in audiobooks, took up the themes of performance, space, gender, politics, and technology, to name just a few. Today, we will be revisiting one of the symposium panels, Feminist Noise, Silence, and Refusal. Lucia Lorenzi, Milena Drumeva, Brady Marks, and Blake Nemec made up this particular panel, and their presentations explored how we understand sound, voice, silence, and voicelessness when they intersect with gender, gender politics, and mandated, expected, or performative speech. First, we have Dr. Lucia Lorenzi, introduced by Dr. Hannah McGregor. Dr. Lorenzi's presentation questions the rising expectations of speech from survivors of sexual violence and assault in an age of social media and virality, and the potential effects that mandating that speech can have on our understanding of voice and silence and noise from activists and survivors.
Welcome, everyone, to Feminist Noise, Silence, and Refusal. I am Hannah McGregor. I'm an assistant professor of publishing here at SFU. Dr. Lucia Lorenzi is an ambivalent scholar, but an excited thinker, finishing up a postdoc in cultural studies at McMaster University.
My dissertation was about silence and representations of sexualized and gendered violence in literature. And the kinds of readings that I was doing felt very literary to me. I was looking for omissions or nonlinear forms of storytelling or particular types of narrative voice. But when I got into performance, namely theater, it became really impossible to avoid thinking through sound as a material experience. So for instance, when I was writing about Colleen Wagner's play, The Monument, in the stage directions, there are silences and long, long, long silences. So trying to think about reading a text and writing about a text that also exists in another world as a performance and as a sonic experience. But as I've done this work over the past decade or so, in addition to my work as an activist and an advocate around these issues, one of the main questions that I keep coming back to is this. Is it necessary to speak out about sexualized and gendered violence? And to what extent has a particular configuration or understanding of sound, and not just voice, created, yes, feminist communities, but also pressures and expectations around the category or the identity of survivor? So perhaps more simply, what I'm trying to think through is how we challenge the binary of speech and silence that characterizes a lot of understandings and representations of violence. So put another way, is there a third option to this formulation proposed by Arundhati Roy, who in her now famous remarks at the 2004 Sydney Peace Prize stated, "We know there's no such thing as the voiceless. There are only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard." I wonder if there's such a thing, and here I'm going to invoke Sarah Ahmed's ideas around willfulness. Could there be something like the willfully silent? And what might those silences, or what I'm calling sonic refusals, look like in an era of digital mediation? The performances I'm looking at are several, but I want to talk about one in particular that stands out to me that I'm still really trying to understand from a sound studies perspective. Emma Salkowitz is a queer, non-binary Asian-American artist who's best known for their 2014-2015 endurance performance piece entitled Mattress Performance, Carry That Weight. And they carry around this standard-sized dorm room mattress everywhere they went on the campus of Columbia University, until either they graduated or their rapist was expelled. They graduated and you see them carrying it with friends across the stage. Their art went viral in part because this work emerged at the height of the student activist movement around campus sexual assault in the United States. Salkowitz was featured on the cover of New York Magazine, and their work was really seen as, I think, emblematic of the campus movement, anti-violence movement more generally. much of their work in the intervening years has not received the same level of public attention, but it's received a great deal of positive critical attention in the art world. And several of their pieces have worked to think through the experience of being a very public survivor of sexual assault, including the kinds of discursive pressures, ways of speaking that have been placed on them. Their 2016 performance, self-portrait, performance with objects, takes place on four pedestals in a gallery space. So on the one pedestal, Salkowitz stands ready to engage in conversation with audience members who are free to ask them about anything. Now, if they want to know about stuff that Salkowitz has been frequently asked, very invasive questions, they are directed to address Emmetron. And Emmetron is a likeness of Salkowitz who speaks via an iPad that is loaded with preset questions and answers you can scroll through. As Matt Stromberg describes in a review for Artbound, quote, "Answers recorded by Salkowitz play from Emmetron's unmoving lips. On the afternoon I visited, these responses were barely audible, unintentionally highlighting the primacy of the interaction with the living, breathing artist in the room." So in the next few minutes, I want to think through how Salkowitz's selective speech and this digital mediation of sound pose both material and discursive or philosophical challenges to how sound and speech have, of course, been used by survivors, but they've also been weaponized against them. I think that their art provides a departure point for thinking about the anti-violence movement as a sonic community and an archive, but to unpack how the production of survivor as a political identity is deeply bound up in particular kinds of sonic production in public space. In his essay collection, Silence, Lectures and Writing, American avant-garde composer John Cage stated, all caps, "I have nothing to say, and I am saying it." So Cage, obviously, his broader arguments work to destabilize the binaries around sound and silence. But I think what he says when he says, "I have nothing to say, and I'm saying it," is talking about one of the most difficult things, I think, about silence. Because it so often risks being misunderstood, it often still requires a narrative apparatus that circles it. Cage speaks in order to give his reasons for not speaking, which is that he has nothing to say. And I've been thinking about Cage as having nothing to say and saying it just because voice, literal voice and mouths, are so important to the imagery of anti-violence movements. The importance of breaking the silence, which suggests a sort of sonic power that is powerful enough to deliberately destabilize objects, perhaps, also exists in relationships to other political movements. While broadly used across anti-violence work of all kinds, the slogan of breaking the silence and imagery such as a person with a hand or tape over their mouth has become also iconic and representative of the ways in which voice, a particular kind of voice, a particular use of that voice, perhaps a particular intonation, has been linked to a particular kind of identity politics. Because a survivor, as opposed to a victim, isn't just someone who speaks, but they break or shatter silences, which calls up this very material instantiation of sound. So shouting or chanting at rallies using a megaphone. And these forms of sonic production are deeply related to feminist practice. We amplify voices, we pass the mic. Now, I'm still struggling with the ways that silence seems to be a kind of counterintuitive mechanism, because I'm aware of the deep history and the weight of politics and oppression that mean that people are silenced or that they are unheard. But I'm also trying to connect this to rich traditions of silence as a means of political disruption. In describing the political strategies employed by American suffragists in the early 20th century, Mary Chapman notes that a key strategy of the suffrage movement was the use of voiceless speech. So obviously the historical context surrounding these activists, and I'm thinking particularly about queer, trans, racialized activists in the 21st century, cannot be in some ways more different. But I think that contemporary activists are still grappling with some of the same difficulties. So to what extent can survivors participate in public spheres of discourse? Where can they use their voice? What are the political risks, including risks to physical safety? Knowing the myriad ways in which survivors continue to be silenced, how can survivors, and I'm going to quote Chapman here, quote, creatively rework the cultural significance of their political silence, changing it from a sign of powerless citizenship to an example of creative forms of participation in the modern public sphere. So Salkowitz's piece helped me think about these creative forms of participation. And I want to make a few suggestions, however preliminary, about how I'm reading how it uses sound and silence. So the first that I think of is this divide in terms of this sort of divide, this little physical divide in terms of how audience members can interact. So Emmetron, the iPad, is still voiced by Salkowitz, but the voice is predefined and limited. And I wonder if it also then resists manipulation. It has boundaries around it. It cannot be altered. I'm thinking about the use of audio recording and the ubiquity of access to voice recording technology, and also the alleged democratization. Listening to Salkowitz's recorded voice isn't a private experience, which sort of seems, you know, my experience of gallery spaces often with sound art, unless it's an exhibition that sort of, you know, is curated in particular ways, that you listen to it in headphones. You're listening to it privately. But as audience members have observed, there's this sort of dual listening where you're trying to listen to the iPad, then you're also trying to listen in. And what's going on with the fact that you don't get to have that private experience? Salkowitz's voice is, this is really interesting to me, described by many reviewers as pleasant and joyful and warm, like as if it's a surprise. And I think that comments on the ways in which survivors' literal voice is also a point of suspicion. A comment on a YouTube video, which provides a little bit of documentation of this piece, one of the commenters says, "She laughs a lot, not sure what's so funny." I've been thinking about reading this laughter alongside the laughter of other performance regarding sexual assault, namely survivors who use stand-up comedy to talk about their experiences and who in that interaction is able to laugh and why, who is laughing at who. And then scrolling through the iPad and thinking about where it is that we now most frequently encounter the voices of survivors and where that archive lives. Because I'm trying to think about the archiving of, you know, the Women's March or other kinds of marches and the ways that that's hard to access versus you can go through and you can literally pick any hashtag that you want and it's really easy to be able to sort of go through that archive and sort of make notes of the kinds of stories that are being told there. So in an article from the early 90s, I think 1994 perhaps, or 91, I can't remember, Linda Alcoff and Laura Gray, they sort of read Foucault to talk about, you know, is survivor speech transgressive, right? So it's almost 30 years ago, and I feel like those questions are coming up, but they're coming up differently because the technologies and the types of public assembly and the way that public assembly is archived or not archived have changed. They say, quote, "When breaking the silence is taken up as the necessary route to recovery as a privileged political tactic, it becomes a coercive imperative on survivors to confess, to recount their assaults, to give details, and even to do so publicly. This is justly deserving of the critique Foucault offers of the way in which the demand to speak involves dominating power." So freedom through speech or voice then is no longer one of a series of possibilities. I worry about the way in which it becomes mandated. And Tarana Burke echoed this recently in an interview with the Washington Post, where she mentioned her frustrations with the goals of the Me Too movement. She says, "Culture shift doesn't happen in the accusation and it doesn't happen in the disclosure. Culture shift happens in the public grappling with these questions because nobody has firm, definitive, or perfect answers." What I wonder then is if we're shifting away from disclosure or the speaking, maybe what we're trying to articulate is a different politics or a different strategies for listening. That seems to be what Burke is calling for. And I also think that's what Salkowitz's piece asks of audience members.
Dr. Lorenzi's presentation recognizes the complicated history around silence, speech, and activists' sonic actions, and her suggestions that sound can exist both as a material experience and a sonic one, and that it can change or impact our understanding of the identity of survivors and the identity of those who do or do not choose to speak, is a theme that can be traced through the following two presentations of this panel. Dr. Milena Drumeva and Brady Marks's presentation questions how social media data, such as tweets, can exist as a soundscape. In particular, what do the hashtag MeToo movement tweets sound like when reinterpreted as sound? And what effect, emotional or otherwise, does sonifying those tweets have on the listener?
Our next speakers are Milena Drumeva and Brady Marks. Dr. Milena Drumeva is a sound studies professor here at SFU in the School of Communication. She does work in critical approaches to urban soundscapes and gender and game sound. And Brady C.L. Marks is a computational artist who is concerned with our technological entanglement and so creates soundscapes that demystify, transgress, and reinterpret our potentially free relationship to tech and framing. What a beautiful bio. And other things. It says and other things.
So we're going to talk a little bit about a sonification that we've created together and do a demonstration, like three different demos. So what is a sonification? Let's start there. For me, a sonification is a reinterpretation of a data set into sound. And the data set that we are interested in exploring is the Me Too phenomenon as represented through tweets. Turning this into sound has a number of different ways to do that. It's very flexible because obviously those tweets don't make sounds in of themselves.
Just to refresh everyone's memory, just in case you know you don't remember what hashtag MeToo is all about or what happened, because our social media memory is, you know, 3 seconds long.
This is the virtual phenomenon, global phenomenon, reacting to sexual intimidation and sexual violence that happened at the end of 2017. And we'll be seeing today how it is still happening online through the sonification, because I'll do a live demo.
We want to ask you some questions about, you know, what this type of representation of information, I don't want to call it data because it's so cold. It's not really data, but it also is. It's accessible as data. But whether, you know, we can think of it as archive or memorial or other things.
I was very inspired by soundscapes as this idea of something that we listen to and we sort of embody and incorporate into our everyday activities. I always come back to the same example, which is like you hear the wet tires of a car on the street in the morning and you know, oh, I should get my umbrella. It's like it's background listening, but it becomes foreground because it's relevant to you. But something that you live with and that becomes sort of acoustic weather that you react to.
I love that. Wait. I just wanted to say something about the choice of sonification, because I do realize that that is new for a lot of folks and unfamiliar. I've been doing work in sonification for a long time, but typically when you go to especially an audio conference or a sonification conference, sonification sounds something like woo. That is what they sound like. They're literally a kind of a pitch-shifting, following a line graph. So a lot of them don't go, like, a lot further than that. We wanted to go, like, a lot further than that with this kind of sonification, because I really got to the point where I wanted to explore what would it mean to create a sonification, not only, you know, sonifying something boring in an interesting way, but sonifying something really interesting in an interesting way. And what would it mean to sonify social data? It's tweets. You can download a data set, but it's people's lives and people's truths that are being shared. It's kind of a voice, but it's silent. So there's a soundscape of that silence in there, and we want to give it voice in a way. Now, what voice would you ask would be given? Well, here's where, just to have fun, because another part of my work has to do with, that I've been chipping away at, has to do with the rather sexist sonic representation of women in video games. If you play any video games, or if you've heard about video games, you probably have seen fighting ladies like these, and you've heard about, you know, the conversations around, well, maybe they should be wearing some more clothes, or, you know, they shouldn't be fighting in a bikini, that kind of thing. Not a lot of talk really about how they sound. But it is very interesting.
Please stop! Please don't! What? No! How? This is wrong!
So these are actual battle cries. These are actual clips from actual characters from actual games. So I've been doing that other work, and I really wanted to bring it in and somehow co-opt it and subvert it and see how I can actually... because what it does is it makes one feel really uncomfortable. It's pornographic, it's sort of really fragile, it's excessive, it's hyper-feminized in a negative way. But I wanted to kind of bring in that discomfort that it creates and use it to sonify the phenomenon of hashtag MeToo and see what that would sound like.
We took these battle cries and we mapped them one-to-one, where each tweet becomes one simple sound. And so with the soundscape paradigm, we're not trying to make music, we're not trying to make notes, we're not using pitch relationships. Every tweet you'll hear is a battle cry. So retweets then become these echoes of that same battle cry. So those are those splurging outs. And there the same cry echoed slightly lower in volume. So again, we wanted to do the counterpoint. We were like, these tweets, we don't want to say that every single one represents someone declaring a event of sexual abuse, which they often are. There was also a strong backlash, right? And we wanted to get this counterpoint. We wanted to get the troll's voice, and we failed at that point. We looked into sentiment analysis. I looked into a few different methodologies. Haven't got that part sorted yet. Another aspect of Me Too that we wanted to represent was this idea of a zeitgeist, of a reach. The fact that all tweets are not exactly equal. There are movers and shakers, people with large followings, and we thought that would correspond to the reach. If someone retweets or tweets and they have a large following...
Like Alyssa Milano, if you remember, there was a big spike in October because Alyssa Milano came forward with her story about Harvey Weinstein, and she has, I mean, anytime she tweets something, she's got millions of people, right? So so that was a big event. And that would be different than, you know, me tweeting something. And I know you're now all dying to hear what this thing sounds like, so drum roll.
I'm going to just do a live one, which is real-time tweets, so they're tweets that are happening right now. They're delayed by 15 seconds just so I can get the timing so they don't bunch up too much. And then I've got some of the historical data sets. We've got a 1 day at 60 times speed, and then we can maybe try the 1 month, which at 1,500 times speed. So this is the zeitgeist layer. So there were four. So that's a retweet. That's a tweet.
Yeah.
was busier during lunch. It was very quiet last night.
Silence is loud. Silence is sound.
We've been reflecting a lot on the silences.
Reach. So notice how many follow reaches. Yeah, so whoever just tweeted there has a lot of followers. It's particularly quiet, actually.
Yeah, I've never heard it so quiet. But it's one of the... that we did want to create, and I want to connect this with your talk, Lucia, is to experience the unfolding of this in time, and just the kind of we're literally waiting for a tweet right now of somebody sharing, possibly sharing a story, responding, commenting.
This is January 10th.
So this is, when you kind of compress time. This is just a gap in the data on the wall. Because it's, I really wanted to prioritize this experiential engagement and see what it sounds like, how we feel, what happens. And it's very much a ongoing work in progress, and I'm very interested in everybody's thoughts and suggestions, both in terms of practical and reactions, but also ways of theorizing that would seem intuitive or natural. Synergies and so on. So thank you.
Milena Dremeva and Brady Marks' presentation indicates, in an uncomfortable, discomforting, thought-provoking manner, the facelessness of social media data and the fact that reinterpretations, as Dr. Dremeva pointed out, tell a story. This particular reinterpretation reminds us all that each contributor to that mass amount of data for the hashtag MeToo movement is an individual, is their experiences, or a contribution to their story because others are engaging with it. Both Dr. Lorenzi's questions about silence and sonic refusal, and Dr. Dremeva and Brady Marks' questions about how silence, noise, and performance can affect our perception or emotional understanding, is found also in the last presentation of this panel. Blake Nemec's presentation questions how the voices of unprotected workers, and even the sounds, pitches, and intonations that these voices make, rather than simply their words, differ from protected workers. Nemec questions how sonic performances, how silence, noise, and unexpected disruption can communicate the emotional and political circumstances of these individuals.
All right, our third speaker is Blake Nemec. Blake Nemec is obsessed with language justice as it intersects with sonic intimacies. He teaches ESL, film, and creative writing in Chicago. It's all yours.
Hi. I feel like my heart is racing a little bit.
I'm just sorry.
No, it's interesting. I mean, you'll see that I do similar things with noise. So, okay. Sonic intimacies of unprotected dialogues. The Molybdenum Project as syncopation, noise, or silence. This analysis queers myths of United Statesian informal trade worker dialogues and their syncopation, noise, or silence by reflecting on the Molybdenum Song Project that I created. Even as this discussion hones in on sex worker conversations, it intentionally troubles the boundaries of this trade to include how other care industry workers who are criminalized, such as domestic workers, talk to each other or do not, or how their sonic interactions differ from those of protected workers. This analysis understands informal trade, unprotected, system D workers as laborers who do not have legal protections while at work. Syncopations and heat, massage workers. I'd like to start with how I experience sonic intimacies with unprotected worker dialogues. Like this clip, beats and rhythms from phonemes and truncated dialogue easily form into song. After I began doing sex work, I found myself repeating clip phrases that I shared with my coworkers. There were regular intonations, and I liked cycling the sound parts in my mouth. Whether it was a little hot or juicy, didn't matter. The content did not hold my connection to the sounds. It was the kind of rhythms, repetitions, or intonations of the phrases that I liked repeating, what enlivened me, and what was animate. In Foucaultian terms, a deeper relationship to the elements of the language can occur below the level of identities and differences, where the foundation provided by continuities, resemblances, repetitions, and natural crisscrossings are found. The Molybdenum Sound Project's creative process was also often syncopated. In 2016, after finishing a manuscript that would become my hybrid book, Sharing Plastic, I reached out to sound artist friends of mine who had also done informal trade work to create a collaborative sound project named Molybdenum. As the collaborators were spread across the United States, we met online to rehearse and created a lot of video conference chatter about the music we could manifest, how our collaborations could grow, or how to make our performances interactive. Then the video conference would pixelate or drop one of us from the call. Our online rehearsals, uncontrollable and truncated, mirrored elements of the informal trade work we were using as source material. The rhythms had feedback or echo. The beats from one piece of equipment would eclipse another. Truncating words allows for rapid dialogue, and fast talk creates energy. Yugoslavian-born experimental fiction writer Dubravka Kugresic speaks about the verbal steam of a communal bath in her book, Lend Me Your Character. This postmodern book of short stories portrays dialogue as heat by including everyday conversations between women as communal bath and verbal steam. listeners don't need to imagine steam or water particles to consider dialogue as animate. Musicology shows us how sentient beings hold emotional connections to sound waves. The idea of language as steam simply assists us in acknowledging sound wave particles as matter. The difference between the verbal seam of protected chatter and unprotected worker conversations, however, exists in the underlying temporality of unprotected worker positions. While making observations when starting, during, or departing work, cognizance about safety, the time, the customer, or the work landscape can be signaled by the intonations within "hello," within the tone of "okay," within the pitches of "oh, I see." Workers who have no job security do not speak to each other like 9-to-5 workers. In my experiences with other unprotected labor, informal work may only have predictable tools their job uses, and coworkers may converse about those tools while sonically implying other information. We may be "uh-huh," or "mm-mm." We can only vocalize interest or critiques through volume, intonation, or tone, because more explicitly, it could cost us arrest, incarceration, or deportation. Coworker chatter in United States secure employment, however, is centered on and validated by what coworkers think of each other's lives in a shared understanding that they will see each other again. The unprotected worker is legally and socially accepted as toxic because the voices are not consistently heard. Mutable is deemed suspicious. The utterances as unprotected workers are less centered on a person's past as I know it and a person's future as I can predict it to be. I or we may only have the sound of their voice, their accent, or the intonation as an element of who they are. I may only have their volume as a sense of their opinions. This is further reason for poetry and music to amplify such dialogues and the elements of them. These art forms can portray the energy or volition of the conversations. It can portray heat, vibration, pulses, and auditory sensations. Molybdenum tracks start with dialogue. Sex workers clean song. The songs or track are different every time because they are created live, surrendering control. Utterances between temporary workers are also unpredictable. Mechanical, geographical, and scheduling challenges paralleled stylistic and contextual elements in the Molybdenum Sound Project. Our equipment compelled us to be ready to change a track mid-performance because the loop pedal, if not pressed softly, would erase all our layered sounds. This loop pedal and the unlimited amount of repetitions of dialogue sounds a temporarily recorded to beats was the core of our sound art. As you heard, we would start with truncated dialogues, then loop phonemes into rhythms or melodies. We knew the looping pedal could erase all the loops during a performance, so prepared for that switch. When it happened during our performances, we had to shift, start over, go into accidental openings, reimagine the track, or recenter our sound. Unprotected workers are similarly ready for change, reframing, and recentering their identities, thus their voices. Every SystemD worker voice has a frequency, a speed pattern, of which they move through the world. And Molly B's speed also had a great range that moved from brilliant to chesty in short amounts of time. Silence. Within Molybdenum, syncopations and delicious switches are equally paralleled by deafening silences. The loop pedal switched could be started after it cut out. First, however, was the silence. Disenfranchised workers talk to each other. They also consistently do not. Silence between workers reflects the reality that many workers cannot communicate because of their worker residency or criminal status. Therefore, some of the poems or tracks have negative spaces or silence to reflect the losses. The lofty idea that workers in conversation are energized is met with portrayals where worker dynamics are iced. It is in these tense worker moments that vulnerable truths of cyclical violence, for example, can emerge. Marginalized or oppressed groups of people, in this case informal trade workers, don't have access to labor right privileges. In Molly B. Denham, we simply allowed the pedal cuts to be, to give silence before starting up again. Melchin discusses toxic animacies, environmental sensitivity, and how a person articulates how vulnerable bodies navigate pollutants, able-bodied people, and syntax. They ask, which bodies can bear the fiction of independence and uninterruptibility? Noise. I began this discussion with my personal one-on-one dialogues with other workers. A further impetus for excavating sonic intimacies or animacies of informal trade worker dialogues in Molly B. Denham came from Days in April, a 2008 grassroots response to the depoliticization of United States May Day. Several meetings were organized for informal workers to gather and speak about their experiences. And these conversations between and among sex workers, domestic workers, farm workers, and hotel workers resulted in alliance building and a room full of transformative noise. This discussion troubles the idea of good worker versus bad worker. It amplifies, remixes unprotected worker dialogues to extremes. It requests listeners to hear cacophonies, screams, loud sirens as sonic landscapes the informal worker navigates, partly to explore ideas of toxicity. Conditions informal trade workers experience are literally toxic, and my sound projects use metaphoric toxicities such as uttered frustrations, then loop and layer such emotionally angry phrases until they evolve into noise. Sound art and poetry remain a vehicle to amplify syncopations, transpoetics, and silent volitions of vulnerable workers, to validate and demand respect by the unprotected. Language shifts and semantic innovations are occurring mid neo-fascist efforts of language and sound solemnization, both working to silence the unprotected. But sound is borderless.
This panel took place almost 8 months ago, but I was able to catch up with Dr. Milena Drumeva recently to talk with her about her symposium presentation. Our discussion, which revisited both the making of the project itself and the presentation of it at the panel that day with Brady Marks, evolved into a discussion about how the impact of sound projects such as hers, particularly because it is based on social media data, can be affected by the means or the frames in which we encounter them. The hashtag MeToo movement happened more than 2 years ago, but by using sonification and using the battle cries of female video game characters to represent tweets, Dr. Drumeva and Brady Marks both troubled and explored the affective or emotional capabilities that interpretations of datasets can carry, even when the term data itself tends to suggest affective or emotional distance. When asked if she had done any further work with the project, Dr. Drumeva answered with a simple,
no.
But as our conversation continued, she shared,
I want to think through it. I don't want to just push it out somehow and somewhere. I don't want it to be an art installation project. I haven't pursued that avenue. How exactly, like how to put it out there and in what form and how to reach a wider audience? I would need partnership for that. I would need funding. And this is not particularly recognized as a form of publication. As you know, the whole project of spoken web and podcasting as academic publishing is something that Hannah McGregor is working on, but it's pretty new.
And as it turns out, the technology currently available does not really support projects like the hashtag MeToo project that Dr. Drumeva and Brady Marks presented at the symposium.
So part of the idea was to, I hate to bore you with these technical details, but the program that we use, which is MaxMSP, does not integrate with any browsers. And browsers typically do not do a great job of embedding audio and of embedding audio software of any kind. So we simply don't have a way of doing that, like technologically. So it's not, it wasn't, that part wasn't even a matter of funding. It's like, we can't. The very technological framework of web browsers does not invite these kinds of audio forms, these kinds of interactive audio forms. So that's something to consider about technology, that it doesn't really allow this kind of sonic exploration.
That web browsers and applications are so well suited to written work, but not to live or exploratory audio work, is particularly interesting to me, especially given the different impacts that can be had via different forms of interacting with something like the hashtag MeToo movement. Dr. Drumeva mentioned during her presentation that our social media memories can be about 3 seconds long. So I asked her if she thought that projects like this one could help create a more lasting impact for movements such as hashtag MeToo.
My answer is no. I don't think it can contribute to anything more lasting. I think that's just the nature of social media. It's just scrolling, 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 clicking, clicking, moving on to the next thing. And this could be another thing in somebody's feed. Now, what I think it can do is I think it can create a different sort of affective relationship, like a different emotional connection to the data, because it's a really different form than the one that we're used to seeing.
Dr. Drumeva's response was surprising to me, as I've been thinking about the project and the presentation since I first heard the recording of it. The female battle cries are discomforting to listen to on their own, and the combination of those battle cries with hashtag MeToo tweets was very intriguing and very powerful, and I told Dr. Drumeva so.
I'm honestly surprised to hear that it's kind of lasting in your mind. So maybe I was wrong and this can be something a little bit more longer lasting. I hope I'm wrong. I just, you're catching me on a day when I feel very bleak about social media culture and the kinds of engagement and disengagement that it produces, and the kind of numbing to impact, the numbing effect that it has on anything emotional. So I think one of the reasons why I haven't, I mean, in addition to things like funding, one of the reasons why I haven't moved forward with it is because it's not very clear to me how to intercept that, like how to interrupt that social media situation and how to most effectively put it out there. So that's honestly, again, still not clear to me, in full honesty.
I asked Dr. Drumeva if hearing the tweets, if listening to the hashtag MeToo movement, has the potential to change our perception of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. Is it more impactful? I don't know. That was the idea. I mean, I've been doing sonification work for a really long time, and only more recently I've been thinking about it as in terms of its emotional impact. Let me tell you about the very first time that I felt emotionally impacted by a sonification. It was a sonification that I heard many years ago at a conference, and it was pretty simple, kind of abstract tones. Not melodic tones, more like almost stochastic kind of rhythmic tones. But it was a sonification of brain EKGs. And this was a researcher who was working to sonify brain waves, and particularly working with epilepsy patients. So he played like the sound of a healthy brain, and then he played the sound of somebody having, like, going into a seizure. And it was really like minimalist and abstract, but it was, all of a sudden I had goosebumps, because it was like hearing somebody going into an epileptic seizure. And it was very simple, but very, like, the lack of it, the lack of other things, the lack of pictures, the lack of text, the lack of anything else, just kind of sitting alone with the sound, even though we were in an audience, was really, really emotionally impactful. And so years later, when I started thinking about the emotional impact of sound or the possibility of emotional impact of sound, a lot of people have written, a lot of sound scholars write about the, you know, sound being a special modality and having a special relationship to our interior world and creating a special kind of intimacy. So I don't know, though. There's a lot of factors, right? There's that, but there's also the fact that you heard it as part of a conference podcast as opposed to came across it in your Facebook feed. Would it have been different if you came across this in your social media feed as opposed to in a conference? And people had a big reaction in the conference, but again, they were there as captive audience. They were there for a certain, with a certain intentionality, you know, and a certain open mind. So I'm really fascinated by this idea of what can create impact, especially about things as important as the Me Too movement and any other subsequent movements that are unfolding on social media. But really, they're not about the virality of social media. They're about real people having experienced harassment and assault and making that public and joining their stories together into a big weave of, you know, evidence.
I asked Dr. Drumeva to speak further about her use of the female battle cries to represent each tweet, each experience, as that's something that I've been trying to theorize since first hearing her presentation.
If I'm understanding correctly, and that's what it makes me think of, is it kind of individuates each tweet and makes you remember that each tweet is an individual who is kind of crying out into the void in whatever way. Because when we think about the hashtag MeToo movement, we even call it a movement. And as soon as you call it a movement, it's like this faceless mass of, you know, it's a event, you know, in the world. It's not individual people with individual stories. Now, this is also not really fair to say that each tweet is an individual with an individual story. That was true in the very beginning of Me Too, but so much of the subsequent activity, at least on social media, is actually a lot of retweets and a lot of meta communication. It's a lot of meta conversations right now. It's a lot of people saying something about the Me Too movement, not necessarily sharing a story. But it's still part of the conversation. And I mean, any sort of data visualization is a story. And I think what I wasn't thinking about this, but now that I heard you describe it in that way, I think what sound helps to do is kind of disentangle individuals and pull them apart from the, you know, the big mass of representation of data.
That was an element of the sheer overwhelm that one feels when they hear the highest period of activity for the hashtag MeToo tweets. Instead of hearing a singular movement, we hear more voices than we can perceive at once. It's an incredibly powerful experience, and it gives context to Brady Marks's comment that, at first, the sonification sounded too pretty, which I mentioned to Dr. Drumeva.
I do remember that. I mean, Brady is a sound artist, and I'm more of a social scientist, really. So it was really interesting working together because we had different conceptions of aesthetics. Through our conversations, I think she started feeling like a different aesthetic, like an anti-aesthetic that was important. You know, we wanted a certain kind of assault on the ear, but not to such a degree that it was incomprehensible and mutually conflicting. And I think we were definitely pushing the envelope a little bit in terms of sound density, because we had obviously every battle cry, battle cry file was triggered by the instance of the hashtag. But then we have echoes on it, which were the number of retweets. And then we had a kind of swelling and receding background drone, which represented the reach of each tweet, judged by the number of followers that particular person has. And that's, you know, really the maximum that I think I wanted to cram into is in terms of information. And it still wouldn't be perceivable on the first listen, right? On the first listen, you just kind of get hit with this emotional reaction and you get it on a very holistic sort of way. Like, wow, that's a lot of Me Too tweets. Like, you get that there's a lot.
Hearing the hashtag MeToo tweets is a very different experience than seeing it represented in visualizations of other kinds, such as line or bar graphs, which amalgamate data in very particular ways. It was an important element of the project for Dr. Drumeva that the data she used be interpreted not as numbers, as data and its traditional connotations, but as individuals.
Every visualization, every transformation of data from numbers to something else is a form of storytelling. Even when we don't want to believe so, and oftentimes visualizations don't say, you know, they say this is data. They don't say this is a story about data. But what it is, it's a story about data because it always is missing certain elements and it's highlighting other elements. And with more new media forms and more unconventional forms of data representation, such as sound, it's more... You can't really get away with saying this is data. You're kind of more on the spot to acknowledge that this is a story about data. But I don't want it to shy away from that at all. The idea was not at all to create some sort of dry scientific representation, right? The whole point was like, yes, this is a story about data, like all the stories about data that are out there. And, you know, let's make this a really interesting story, a really impactful one.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian literary archival recordings found at universities across Canada. Our producers this month are Kate Moffat and Michelle Levy of Simon Fraser University. And our podcast project manager is Stacey Copeland. Thanks to Milena Drumeva, Lucia Lorenzi, Brady Marks, and Blake Nemec for their candid discussions presented here. This episode features archival audio from the Spoken Web Sound Institute 2019 and the Spoken Web Symposium 2019 at Simon Fraser University. Special thanks go out to Michelle Levy and the entire SFU Spoken Web team. To find out more about Spoken Web and our next symposium in 2020, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. We'll see you back here next month for another episode of the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds.